is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, January 5, 2005. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Growing calls from Iraq to postpone the upcoming elections as violence continues to rock the country. We preview tomorrow's Senate confirmation hearings of Alberto Gonzalez to head the Justice Department. And as rescue efforts continue 10 days after the tsunami, we hear from the head of UNICEF, who's just visited the Tamil Tiger-controlled area of Sri Lanka. Plus other national and international stories right after these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Internal Pentagon budget documents leaked to the press show that the military will be scaling back on futuristic weaponry in deference to the budget deficit and to cope with operations in the present. The Bush administration's Keystone missile defense program is marked to lose $5 billion. By contrast, Army ground operations will see a big hike, but in the Rumsfeld style, to create lighter, more flexible units. Some defense experts are critical of the proposal, saying it has no coherent vision. Final decisions on the 2006 budget request will be made in 2 weeks. Voting rights activists are gathering in the nation's capital, ready to protest Congress's pending certification of the presidential election. Becky Paulstrom has more from D.C.
Ohio voters claiming they've been disenfranchised have ended their protest bus ride from the state capital to the nation's capital in an effort to emulate the Freedom Civil Rights Campaign of 1964. The organization We Do Not Concede organized the ride to draw attention to the problems in the Ohio election in November. These ranged from claims of direct voter intimidation to malfunctioning or inaccurate machines. Through the bus campaign, they hope to encourage Congress to support Representative John Conyers' proposal to challenge the Ohio vote. Kat Lestrange, director of We Do Not Concede, in an interview today.
They want to share their stories. It's about putting a human face here on this issue. It's not something that's out there. You know, they're going to be right here in front of them.
Conyers, the ranking member on the House Judiciary Committee, will attempt to block the certification of the Ohio vote before the joint session of Congress tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Becky Palmstrom.
U.S. employers slashed over 1 million jobs last year and continued a four-year trend. Sarah Turner has more.
Layoffs are on the rise, according to a report released today by outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas.
Over President Bush's first term, on net, we're probably down a couple of 100,000 jobs.
Jared Bernstein is a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. In December, a month that usually shows a dip in job cuts, U.S. layoffs actually increased by more than 4%. Bernstein says those who survived this year's round of layoffs are still hurting because real wages haven't gotten a boost since the start of 2001. Total job losses will be more than 1 million for the fourth year running, and Bernstein says many new jobs are in low-paying service industries. He also thinks the future looks grim for those depending on unemployment benefits.
Congress failed to enact extensions of the program as they had in the past. And now we're looking at a system where millions have exhausted their unemployment insurance benefits and still haven't found a job.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Turner.
Italy is set to export 99% of its nuclear waste to the United Kingdom, even though UK officials are hard-pressed to locate sites for their own waste. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Today's announcement about British plans to dispose of 235 tons of spent fuel from Italy's long decommissioned reactors has confirmed fears that Britain is becoming the dumping ground of Europe. Critics say the UK is unable to handle its own waste, and it's not expected to find a new depository for another 30 years. Britain has long profited from lucrative nuclear fuel reprocessing contracts, and for 30 years politicians have promised the British public that leftover waste would always be returned to the countries of origin. But just before Christmas, the British government changed its mind, announcing that a total of 225 nuclear shipments worth of Japanese, German, Spanish, Swiss and Swedish nuclear waste would be buried on British soil in a deal worth £680 million. This new scheme to reprocess and bury Italy's waste is worth £200 million. the British government has refused to publish details of its contracts with Italy. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
A Colorado state legislator wants to ensure that everyone knows about the dangers of a former weapons site that others want to convert into a wilderness area. Leslie Clark reports from Denver.
Members of the Citizen Inspectionist are announcing new legislation today in the Colorado House of Representatives. Newly elected Representative Wes McKinley was the foreman of the 1989 grand jury that investigated environmental crimes at the former Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant. Representative McKinley says his new law would inform the public of the dangers of the proposed wilderness area at the former weapons plant. That means at Rocky Flats, the visitor center would be required to inform the public of plutonium contamination there and the possible health risks. McKinley plans to introduce the bill as soon as the Colorado legislature convenes next week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Denver.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
In Iraq today, a suicide car bombing at a police station in Hilla, about 60 miles south of Baghdad, killed at least 20 people as new officers took part in a graduation ceremony. In the capital, a car bomb aimed at a U.S. convoy killed two Iraqis, and in Bakuba to the northeast, a suicide car bombing at a checkpoint killed five police officers. According to the Ministry of the Interior, more than 1,300 police officers have been killed in the last 4 months. The violence has prompted a new wave of calls to postpone the upcoming elections. FSRN's Dave Enders files this report from Baghdad.
At a press conference today, U.S.-appointed Prime Minister Ayad Alawi said efforts would be made to equip the Iraqi Army and National Guard with more weapons and armored vehicles before the scheduled election date of January 30th, and that a number of soldiers currently being trained would be ready before then. Alawi also responded to recent statements from members of the government, including President Raziel Yawar and Defense Minister Hazem Shallan, that postponing elections should be considered.
What we have to respect, the government of Iraq, the mandate and the authority which was given to us by the United Nations, by the Security Council, that an election should be held by the 30th of January 2005.
A UN spokeswoman said yesterday that nothing will be done unless Iraq's Independent Election Council called on them to do so. Major Sunni political parties are calling for a boycott or postponement of the vote, though some Iraqis say it may not make much of a difference. Ali Hussein is a taxi driver and a Shiite.
The only way to have a constitution is to hold elections. I will go to vote even if there is a bomb, even if I die. My wife is Sunni, and even she will vote.
It seems unlikely any change would be made in the date of the elections without the approval of Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the Shiite religious leader whose support was instrumental in setting an election date in the first place. A look at the slate of Alawi's own party gives an idea of how integral the Shiite religious structure is in holding elections.
A lot of the campaign literature for the United Iraqi Alliance features the slogan endorsed by the Murjaiya, or a lot of times there's a picture of Ayatollah Sistani on there. What problems does that pose for you and other candidates? And, you know, are there any plans to do anything about it?
But let me tell you, I'm here as a prime minister. I'm not here representing my own. My focus is really for all Iraqis to participate, and ultimately the Iraqi people will be the judge to choose whoever they wish and think that they would serve.
Some analysts have predicted that Shiites, who make up about 60% of the population, will turn out heavily, while Sunnis, who make up between 20 and 25% of the population, will boycott entirely, polarizing the country. If elections do go forward, it remains to be seen whether some Sunnah, especially secular ones, will resign themselves to voting, even if only as a sign of optimism for a process that some hope represents a small step forward. What everyone does agree upon is that whether elections are held on the 30th, the violence and bloodshed will continue past then. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Cuban-born Carlos Gutierrez testified to the Senate Commerce, Science and Transportation Committee today on his nomination to replace Donald Evans as Secretary of Commerce. Gutierrez's nomination is likely, which would make him the first Latino to head the Commerce Department. Gutierrez made his fortune as the CEO of the Kellogg Corporation. As Gutierrez leaves Kellogg, the cereal giant is giving him an annual pension payment beginning 2009 of $1.3 million. Meanwhile, an alliance between torture survivor and veteran groups are campaigning the Senate to reject President Bush's nomination of Alberto Gonzalez, who'll testify tomorrow in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee to become the next Attorney General. Mitch Jeserich reports from D.C.
Survivors of torture are appalled that he is even being considered to serve or to be the next Attorney General.
Sister Deanna Ortiz is a torture survivor. In 1989, she was taken to a secret torture chamber in Guatemala City, where she was raped, burned over 100 times, and forced to hold the end of a knife as one of her torturers stabbed another woman. Now, as founder of the organization Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition, Ortiz is speaking out against the nomination of Alberto Gonzalez to become the next Attorney General. Her opposition stems from at least one memo written by Gonzalez as White House counsel in 2002 that called the Geneva Accords to protect prisoners of war quaint and obsolete, and that they did not apply to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Sister Ortiz.
For those of us who have been tortured and have survived torture, it's a life sentence. And it's a reminder to us that torture's ghost walks with us every single day of our lives, reminding us that the past is not gone. And hearing conversations of whether torture is justified, what, or should it be permissible, is so disturbing and just creates a storm within me personally. I can't even believe that we're asking that question, should it be justified?
Your organization has tried to get a torture survivor to testify at tomorrow's hearing with Alberto Gonzalez?
Our request was denied, but we will also have survivors present during the hearing. And, you know, I go back to what many survivors of torture have shared with me, that during their torture, their torturers said to them that if they survived, no one would believe them and no one would care. And in many ways, that is the type of response that we're getting from our own government.
Alberto Gonzalez will likely face tough questioning on the torture memos from Democrats during his confirmation hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday. The ranking Democrat of the committee, Senator Patrick Leahy, said that Gonzalez's failure to hand over 8 documents concerning torture will be a contentious issue. Several former military officers have signed a letter expressing grave concern that Gonzalez appears to have helped shape policy with interrogative practices, which the letter says could lead other nations to do the same, including with U.S. prisoners of war. Richard Class, a retired Air Force colonel, says this makes Gonzalez unfit to become the nation's top law enforcement officer.
He has shown an ability to skirt the law, to interpret the law to suit political purposes. There are two sorts of lawyers. There are lawyers who tell people how far they can go under the law, and there are lawyers who tell their bosses how to get around the law. And Alberto Gonzalez appears, at least in the torture case, to be the second. And unless he proves otherwise, I don't think we can have the man in charge of justice in the United States have that kind of an attitude, nor do I think we ought to have him in the one position where there might be an investigation of what really happened in bringing people to accountability.
Human rights groups are hopeful that the new attention on torture brought by Gonzalez's nomination will spur Congress to further address the issue. Orlando Teason with the Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition was tortured by the Ferdinand Marcos regime in the Philippines during the 1980s.
I think we should all press for an independent investigation of what happened in Iraq, Guantanamo, Afghanistan, what's going on after 9/11. And I think if this is successful, if citizens can successfully ask for this, then this will be a big stepping stone to investigating other cases of involvement of torture by U.S. Agencies.
Gonzalez does have support from Republican senators, and his confirmation is expected. Also supporting Gonzalez's nomination is the National Council of La Raza, which did not return phone calls for comment. Mitch Jeserich, Free Speech Radio News.
Reports now say some 158,000 people have died from the tsunami disaster in South Asia and Africa. In Sri Lanka, the official death toll is over 48,000. Pouring rains in the east have tempered the rescue and clearing operations, and in the northern Tamil Tiger-controlled regions, aid has been slow to reach. Carol Bellamy is the executive director of UNICEF. She visited a village in the north called Mulathivu. There she spoke with FSRN's Purnaya Manikavasagam.
The assistance of the UNICEF, will it go through the government or will it go direct to the LTT? Through what mechanism it will go?
Well, I was pleased to meet with the task force in Mulathivu City, which was set up that contains members of the representation from the government and representation from the LTTE. We will not change our means of delivering assistance. We will continue to deliver as we do today. We work with the LTTE and we work with the government. So, for example, medicines that are coming in, that will be distributed through the government authorities, through the government agents. But we will work closely with the LTTE as well, as we have here in the north.
Carol Bellamy, executive director of UNICEF, speaking there in Sri Lanka with FSRN's Purnaya Manikavasagam. Former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet was placed under house arrest today after Chile's top court ruled that murder and kidnapping charges against him can go forward. FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports from Santiago.
The second chamber has affirmed the appeals court decision, denying the Augusto Pinochet appeal.
Cheering and clapping received the landmark decision Tuesday of Chile's Supreme Court to give the go-ahead to the prosecution of former dictator Augusto Pinochet for the forced kidnapping of 9 people and murder of another in what is known as Operation Condor. The decision paves the way for Pinochet to face charges on human rights crimes for the first time. Operation Condor was a 1970s alliance of 6 South American dictatorships to persecute and kill perceived opponents to the military regimes. The decision was greeted with applause and cheering. Particularly pleased with this decision was Viviana Diaz, the longtime leader of the Association of Detain and Disappear. Diaz has spearheaded the fight to prosecute Pinochet for the past 15 years.
Pinochet must be prosecuted for his crimes in Operation Condor. We are extremely happy. Finally, we received great news at the beginning of the year that he will face the courts accordingly.
The happiness was palpable, not only in her voice, but in her face and that of the family members of those killed and forcefully disappeared by the Pinochet dictatorship. Other family members cried with joy after finally seeing the day that Pinochet is forced to face criminal charges for human rights violations that, according to Chile's government records, killed nearly 3,000, imprisoned and tortured nearly 35,000, and exiled nearly a million of its citizens. For his part, lawyer Eduardo Contreras, who has fought Pinochet in the courts, was exuberant after finally seeing his legal work pay off.
It is an emotional moment for us. Local and international public opinion is touched by the 150,000 victims of the tsunami in Asia. But if you take into account all those who were disappeared, killed, tortured, or exiled in Chile, Pinochet's victims are greater than those in Asia. The world should be moved by this decision that the person criminally and politically responsible for the genocide that took place in Chile is indicted and under arrest. I believe these are reasons to be moved.
Contreras' happiness is not trivial. In 2002, he witnessed how the same Supreme Court absolved Pinochet in another important human rights case on health grounds, after the court found his ailing health prevented Pinochet from facing prosecution. But the times are different. Pinochet's own actions forced the court's response. This past year, he gave a lively interview to a Miami television station, and later a U.S. Senate inquiry found bank accounts totaling millions of dollars and the fake names in Washington's Riggs Bank. These two events changed the Supreme Court's thinking, giving the go-ahead to prosecuting Judge Juan Guzman to continue with Pinochet's prosecution in Operation Condor. Operation Condor was a security operation created by the Pinochet regime that brought together 6 South American dictatorships to persecute and kill perceived opponents. This terror network not only operated in the region, it also reached outside of its borders, extending its terrorist activities to Europe and United States. In fact, the first acknowledged foreign terrorist act perpetrated on U.S. soil was carried out in September 1976 by Operation Condor operatives who exploded a car bomb in Washington's Embassy Row, killing Chile's former ambassador to Washington, Orlando Letelier, and his U.S. associate, Ronnie Moffitt. On Santiago Street, the court's decision was given a muted response. Some called the decision a political persecution against Pinochet, but the majority said it was time for him to face justice.
I think it is a good decision. We have been waiting for a long time for a resolution and for Pinochet to face justice.
It's positive, really positive, because many people suffered under the Pinochet government.
This is an unlimited persecution, that is my opinion.
And at midday today, the aging dictator was placed under house arrest in his coastal country state on orders by Judge Guzman. The next step is for the Pinochet defense to respond to the charges before Judge Guzman issues a finding of guilt. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Just before Christmas, the National Forest Service issued new rules for speeding up the planning process for each of the 175 national forests and grasslands. Environmentalists say the rules take away essential tools protecting wildlife and public involvement by making wildlife surveys and public input optional when working on each forest's 15-year plan. Lee Robardis has more from FSRN affiliate KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Some national forests have spent as long as 7 years coming up with their forest plans, which guide logging, mining, recreation, and ecological efforts for 15 years. Forest officials have long complained the process, which involves viability studies for all species and public comment periods, is too cumbersome. In announcing the new planning rules, the Forest Service paints the old rules as outmoded. Sally Collins is Associate Forest Service Chief.
We have to have a rule that really addresses the issues and threats of the decades ahead, not the issues that framed the past.
Chris West of the American Forest Resource Council, a timber industry group based in Portland, says environmental rules and public comment provisions still remain in effect for individual projects, such as timber sales on national forest land.
To require another level of analysis at the planning level, where at the forest level, where we're only talking about revisions and updating of these plans, is, in our view, a waste of money. And for those that want to obstruct or make the national forests into national parks, sure, they're upset because they're going to lose an opportunity, maybe, to challenge forest plan revisions in court.
To Gary McFarlane of the Idaho-based Forest Watch group Friends of the Clearwater, the Forest Service is playing a shell game because decisions about individual projects have traditionally referred back to the forest's plan for guidance, but now there's no public participation requirements for those plans.
So we've got this catch-22. Nobody really knows when the decisions were made, and that's exactly done by intent.
Under the new rules for forest plans, viability studies for all species on the forests are no longer required, and neither are environmental impact statements. While supporters of the rule change point out forests must still protect species under the Endangered Species Act, McFarland sees this as another shell game.
On one hand, they're saying, well, we don't need viability standards for species, because we have something like the Endangered Species Act. We have the emergency room. But they're also gutting the Endangered Species Act. So there really isn't an emergency room. So a lot of species are going to fall through the cracks.
McFarland believes not requiring studies of species in forest plans means no money will be allocated for studies, which in turn means degraded watersheds across the landscape. Mike Anderson of the Wilderness Society says another major change in the rules is that the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, will no longer apply to the planning process.
That means that there will be no environmental analysis, there will be no alternatives to the Forest Service's plans for the public to consider and to recommend. Just a lot less information presented about the potential options for management of the forest.
Anderson says there's a good possibility the December 22nd executive order violates the National Forest Management Act or the National Environmental Policy Act.
We'll be looking very closely at the details of these regulations and may well decide to pursue that legal challenge in court.
A public comment period on the new forest planning rules ends February 20th. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robardis in Moscow, Idaho.
And now FSRN commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row.
The water wars. The recent visions of the tsunami rushing, raging, tearing through the Asian coasts has given us all some interesting insights into the truly stunning and indeed awesome power of water and how nature's fury is virtually boundless when unleashed. Yet there is another watery war that is being waged that may affect the lives of billions, but it garners neither the concern nor really the attention of the world's media. The electronic media, especially, thrives on drama and conflict and seeks pictures and stories which reflect those features. It also affirms the positions of the privileged as opposed to the plight of the poor and powerless. Yet all across the globe, in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and even here in North America, people are living under the very real threat of the corporatization of water and water systems. The waters of the earth, which have been since the dawn of human civilization for the collective usage of the community, is fast becoming just another commodity, something to sell. If you can afford it, cool. If not, tough. Michael Stark, a senior executive at U.S. Filter, a subsidiary of the multinational corporation Vivendi, put it this way. Water is a critical and necessary ingredient to the daily life of every human being, and it is also an equally powerful ingredient for powerful manufacturing companies. Veronica Lake, a Michigan-based environmental activist, has noted that corporations acquire the world's water by three major methods. A, by water mining, the underground aquifers or deep sources of many of the world's streams or rivers. B, by leasing state and government water systems and collecting revenues. And C, by managing city water systems. In short, there's money in water. And where money is, there too are corporations trying to get paid. That's the dark, unforeseen, and treacherous side of the globalization movement among Western governments and corporations. That's also what privatization really means, taking the common inheritance of nature and making it into someone else's private property. In South Africa, this movement has resulted in more misery for the poor. Indeed, cholera rates are higher now there than in the days of apartheid. It's often the result of tough austerity measures imposed by the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund, where governments are privatizing essential services, and the cost of living now means the right to buy water to live. Nor is this merely a story for the distant third world. In Detroit, Michigan today, some 40,000 people on the southwest side have had their water shut off for non-payment. In many older buildings, water isn't just the stuff that's supposed to run through faucets. It also provides steam heat through old radiators. So, no water means no heat in Detroit. Scholars say that the next world wars will be fought not for oil, but for water, for it is infinitely more precious. Thankfully, people all over the world, in South Africa, in Plashimada, India, in Bolivia, in Brazil, in France, Ghana, and Canada, are fighting both their sellout governments and the corporations for the human right of free access to water. Those of you who have heard my earlier pieces may remember the Bolivian water wars in a place called Cochabamba. There, a popular group calling itself La Coordinadora de Defensa del Agua y la Vida, the Defense Committee in Defense of Water and Life, organized the poor, the homeless, the streetwalkers, and everyone they could to oppose the corporatization of their water. They ran out the Bechtel Corporation. It must spread, or else water will become as rare as gold and as expensive. From Death Row, for Free Speech Radio News, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.